Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you again, and welcome back to Through the Wealth Lens. I'm Ryan Ruff, your moderator, and as always, I will be joined by Hannes Grascher. Of course, Hannes being a private wealth advisor at UBS International and a fellow UBS advisor in Max Grascher. We're going to be jumping into a really interesting conversation today, and if you're a frequent listener on this show, that you know that we've talked several times before about athletes and entertainers and some of the challenge that these individuals and, of course, their families face when coming into sudden wealth. After signing that first big contract or that record deal. Well, today we're going to be diving into another subject that concerns athletes in particular, even before they hit the professional landscape. And so what are we talking about? We're talking about NIL. Of course, that's name, image, and likeness. Now, we're going to be diving into this subject today, and based on one of UBS's recently released white papers, which was entitled The NIL Playbook, How to Navigate the Name, Image, and Likeness Landscape. Today's discussion is going to be exploring some of those key points from that white paper and navigating NIL compensation successfully, how you can do it, of course. And we're really lucky today to be joined by a guest expert who's an entertainment attorney and a partner at Greenberg Traurig, and that's Paul Sarker. We are super excited to have Paul on board to tap into his expertise. But before we bring Paul on, let's say hi to the guys. Hannes and Max, great to see you today. How are we doing?
Hey, Ryan. Good to be back.
Thanks for having us again, Ryan.
And Paul, we really appreciate you carving some time out of your busy schedule to jump on. Paul, welcome to Through the Wealth Lens.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's an honor.
Well, hey, no, we're happy to have you. I'm excited to jump into today's discussion. Hannes and Max, why don't you guys have kind of kick things off for us today? For those of our listeners that are maybe new to the subject, what exactly is NIL? And why would you say it's become such a popular topic of discussion in today's entertainment and predominantly, the athletics landscape?
Yeah, sure, Ryan. So as many people know, NIL has been kind of the hot topic lately when it comes to college sports and even now high school sports. But until recently, the NCAA prohibited student athletes and high school athletes that are interested in competing at the college level from benefiting in any financial way while playing for their school. So a lot of people found this pretty unjust given how much money schools would generate between merchandise sales, ticket sales, what they were taking in from broadcast revenue, brand partnerships, etc. So in 2014, actually, UCLA basketball star Ed O'Bannon and several other Division I athletes filed a lawsuit against the NCAA. So that was eventually settled. And actually resulted in the NCAA paying former student athletes an average of around $1,600 in damages, plus their attorney fees. So we fast forward to 2021, a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, highest court in the land, stated that the NCAA, limits on what athletes can be compensated for was actually a violation of U.S. antitrust laws. So this really opened up the way for states to determine how athletes can benefit financially off their name, image, and likeness, otherwise known as NIL. The thing is, right now, there aren't any federal laws governing NIL. So it really creates disparities among regions, different divisions, conferences, schools, which results in recruiting advantages and disadvantages. Schools with more defined NIL laws have advantages compared to those without.
Yeah, and just to jump in, again, Paul Sarker here, to sort of add a little bit more context to that. I think it's interesting as a lawyer, first and foremost, because I'm a fan of sports, college football, college basketball. I watched those growing up. And it's no secret, they're very popular throughout the country. And that's led to college football and college basketball and the NCAA being big business, right? We talked about it. Max, you mentioned it. In any given year, schools in the SEC and Big Ten are now making $50, $60 million in rights fees each. The NCAA is making probably $4 billion in football revenue a year. So it's big dollars. And for the longest time, the NCAA has said, players can't get paid, right? So they're keeping the labor costs really low. And meanwhile, coaches are getting $11 million a year. Athletic directors are getting $2 to $5 million a year. Commissioners are getting, you know, $5 million a year. And so the money's there. It's just not going to the players. And that, I think, was the cause of a lot of frustration. And as you said, Hans, it was a slow sort of like process, you know, because the NCAA has been very staunch in their position. Hey, players need to be amateurs. They can't get paid. And, you know, you said it started with the Ed O'Bannon case and then the Alston case in 2021. And even in between then, California and other states passed laws saying, hey, if you have a policy that prevents student athletes from earning money, that's not going to be enforceable in the state. So all of those factors made the NCAA do a quick pivot in 2021. Now, what they didn't do is they didn't completely open things up. They said, hey, we're not going to let people get paid to play, but we are going to let people, student athletes, earn a compensation from the use of their name, image, and likeness. So essentially they can do endorsement deals, but you can't get paid to be the starting quarterback for Alabama. You can't get paid for winning a national championship. You can't get paid for having 30 touchdowns, right? Like, you can't get paid to perform. That's still prohibited by the NCAA, but you can tweet about a local pizza place. You can tweet about your apartment complex. You can do other things that are endorsement related and get paid that way. And so the NCAA thought that would be a good compromise to sort of let players, especially prominent ones, get a piece of the economics without giving up their amateurism argument.
Sure thing. Thanks, Paul, for kind of peeling back the curtain on it for us. Paul, as an entertainment attorney at a, you know, a major corporate firm, what's your personal experience been like, you know, working, navigating this landscape of NIL and, you know, even with your own clients?
So, you know, it's funny. I've been following it for a long time because, as I said, I'm a big college sports fan. I went to Duke, which had, you know, a premier program for a long time and still probably in the elites, but now in the NIL world, it's a lot different, right? Because it's not just about the strength of your coaching, your athletic facilities. Players can get money from collectives to play, and that's changed the dynamic. So as a fan, I was interested in it, and I saw when there were sort of rumblings that the NCAA was going to change its policy in 2020, and then when it officially did it in 2021, I started covering it, writing articles about it, doing a lot of research. And I would say from my perspective at a major corporate firm, it was a lot of sort of research without a ton of work. I mean, let's just give you sort of broad strokes. The NIL market is estimated to be about $1 billion and it could grow to $5 billion. And the vast majority of those deals are pretty small to the point where someone wouldn't necessarily hire a lawyer like me to represent them in that deal. If it's a couple grand, they probably wouldn't hire a lawyer like me. They should have some representation, but you know, the deals are getting bigger. At the top of the food chain, you have like LeBron James' son is getting $7 million. Olivia Dunn's getting $3.5 million. So those deals are substantial, but most of them are small right now. So a lot of what I do is I represent clients who are brands, apartment owners, apparel manufacturers, you know, brands like that who are doing deals with college athletes, and they want to paper it from their perspective. So they may do a deal with, you know, a prominent Big Ten team or athlete or a collective, and they want to do it the right way. So I'm doing a lot more brand deals than representing talent. I understand. But, you know, it's the same contract, right? It's just from two different perspectives.
Sure. And, you know, it certainly does sound like this is a difficult topic to navigate, especially given how new it really is at the moment. Also, couple the fact that we're talking about teenagers and their parents that have limited experience probably in dealing with money at such a large scale. So, Hannes, I'll throw this next question over to you. When we're talking about the, you know, these high school and college athletes that are experiencing this moment who do ultimately sign NIL deals, let's talk about the money. Who exactly is paying them? You know, how is the money finding its way into their accounts, shall we say?
Yeah, really good question, Ryan. So while a small group of top and high profile athletes may benefit from lucrative NIL deals, and Paul just mentioned LeBron's son, Bonnie James, and LSU basketball star Angel Reese, most deals are funded through university alumni and supporters via groups called collectives. The collectives are set up and funded by these boosters who want to provide NIL opportunities to student athletes at their respective schools. Obviously, schools with bigger and wealthy alumni bases have bigger collectives and can use this to retain top-notch student athletes. They raise money, then pay the athletes to endorse or use their product or services, generally on personal social media accounts. And while the NCAA allows athletes to get endorsement deals on their own, they currently do not share revenues with the student athletes. So at the high school level, student athletes being recruited to play at the next level obviously have a greater incentive to attend a school with clear rules protecting NIL rights and large collectives.
All right, Roger that. And guys, typically in your eyes, once a student athlete does have the opportunity to sign an NIL deal, what are generally some of the best practices in terms of managing that influx of kind of sudden wealth, if you will?
Yeah, sure, Ryan. So really the first point that we want to emphasize for a strong NIL game plan is really making sure the athlete and those around him understand or her understand the financial basics. So, you know, for a lot of these players and college or high school athletes, this money is really some of the first income that they're ever going to see hit their bank accounts. You know, they have to do their homework on what the U.S. financial system's like. So banks, investments, taxes, really before they receive that first check. And look, most schools have pretty good resources for researching these topics. So, you know, they can go to their athletic departments. They have, you know, their local banks or local financial advisors that they can reach out to. You know, an example is understanding how compounding helps investments generate their own earnings over time. That's a basic principle, but it's one that can prove invaluable if they learn kind of what that means from an early point. And to kind of expand on that point of self-education, the second principle we like to focus on is really doing your homework about a particular school and the state's NIL rules and laws. You know, what situation would you be protected in as the student athlete, best or worst? You know, seek out independent educational resources other than just those provided by the NIL collectives, because at the end of the day, this is a business for them. You need to make sure that you're covered from all angles.
Yeah, and Ryan, and so we understand that as young adults and teenagers, many student athletes will not realize what they need to do to educate themselves or exactly where to go initially. And that's why, just like we recommend to our professional athletes, build a team of trusted advisors that can guide you through the process. Now, these advisors can be coaches, parents, agents, legal professionals, and financial advisors. And these advisors should be experienced in negotiating NIL deals. Be wary of individuals or groups overpromising results. Research those offering to help, and so you don't find yourself in a predatory situation in the future. And just like the NCAA and the educational institutions student athletes represent, they must think of themselves as a business. Your most important asset is you. It is important that student athletes recognize both their strengths and weaknesses and playing to those strengths. For example, are you good speaking with the media? Do you feel comfortable and nervous in front of the camera? Do you have a strong social media following? These can all be used to earn money via NIL deals.
And I just want to get Paul's perspective as well on that, because he's definitely seen it firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything you guys said is spot on in terms of having a team, understanding the landscape, and sort of managing your brand, looking at yourself as a business and having a long-term view, because like your incentives may not necessarily be aligned to the collective, right? Like maybe the collective's incentive is to get you to sign a letter of intent to play football for a year or a couple of years, or basketball, to get you into the university on the roster. And maybe your incentive is 20, 30 years, right? Maximizing your earning potential and not closing any doors. So if, for example, someone signs you to a long-term deal that, or potentially a long-term deal that's exclusive, and it prevents you from doing other things in the future, that could be a problem. So I think you really have to, I mean, and as a, you know, high school or college athlete, like, how are you supposed to know this stuff? You know, we've all been doing this for over a decade. So I've seen, you know, hundreds of deals. I've negotiated all these different permutations of deals, and I've seen things go wrong and I've seen things go right. So you can leverage your team's experience and sort of ask them, but ultimately, you know, you're going to be making decisions because you're going to know what's best for you, or you're going to have your best interest at heart. I would say, looking at it as like a flow chart, right? As you said earlier, Max, there's no federal NIL law, right? So basically the NCAA punted it to the states, and now the states can do what they want. And that may change. It may be, there's been 11 congressional hearings on NIL. Congress probably has bigger priorities, you know, with the election coming up and, you know, potentially inflation, all these other things, border security. They may not come up with an NIL policy in the short term, but that may, if they do, that could change everything. But right now it's on you to sort of know the state policy of the school that you're in, to know your school's policy and comply with it, to know that you have a good team in place and that you can basically rely on them. Because sometimes there's people out there who aren't necessarily looking out for your best interest. And then the other thing, when it comes down to the deal itself, is managing the contract. You should read it. You should know what you're agreeing to. Things like exclusivity, what your approval rights might be. If you're creating content, how much do you have to create? How long can the other side use it? Is it just a year? Is it forever? Is there anything in there about being required to be a student in the university in good standing? Because that isn't necessarily allowed, but that's something that you would have to understand based on what the NCAA and university policies are. Then the economics, I think, are another big component of it. Like, you see a lot of times, you know, maybe you get paid in cash. Maybe someone says, hey, I'll give you equity in this company instead of cash, or I'll pay you in crypto. Sometimes that can get you into hot water. You know, a couple of years ago, a lot of people were getting huge deals from FTX and getting paid in FTX's token. And, you know, that's worth nothing now. So sometimes it's just being really careful and intentional about how you're getting paid, how the deal works, and make sure you understand it. Because if someone's explaining it to you in terms and you don't fully grasp it, but they're pressuring you to sign, that's a red flag to me. I mean, you should really have a clear understanding of what you're getting paid and what you have to do for it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what Hannes and Paul just stated, just went through, you know, it pairs well with kind of the last point that we want to make, you know, to successfully manage that NIL deal. You know, you have to manage your brand as a student athlete. You know, your brand is valued based on how you conduct yourself on the field or court. You know, it can be strengthened or it can be weakened by what you do off of it. So, because NIL deals really enhance your visibility in the public eye, you need the right team that has experience with brand and reputational management. So we've seen it with professional athletes countless times, and we'll most likely see it again. You know, a post on social media or, you know, a negative interview can really destroy an athlete's brand and hurt the cash flow, you know, for those athletes. You know, you got to make sure that the brands also align with your values. You know, no one wants to sign any random company, you know, just to receive a paycheck and then deal with the public backlash, you know, especially if the company comes under scrutiny for something. So these are all really important points to consider.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. I appreciate all the insight here. And before we tie a bow on today's conversation, there's another big avenue I want to make sure we travel down. And it, although you guys are not CPAs and you don't give tax advice, we've talked plenty of times on this show about how taxes do play such a significant role in a client's overall financial plan. So with respect to taxes and NIL, what should student athletes really know about the intersection of these two worlds of taxes and their NIL deals?
Yeah, again, and I want to emphasize we're not accountants. We don't give tax advice, but there's some general principles that everybody should be aware of. And so, like income earned from your typical 9-to-5 job, income received from an NIL deal is taxed at an ordinary income tax rate. So this means that if a player receives $1 million for a deal, they don't have $1 million in the bank to spend. The $1 million is a gross amount, meaning they will owe a significant income tax on it. So if a student athlete isn't aware of this, and they may not be, they've never had a job or paid taxes, right? And they spend the $1 million they awarded in the deal, when the tax bill comes due, it will be a shock to say the least. So any athlete involved in an NIL deal should have a qualified tax professional on his or her team to plan for taxes that will become due.
Of course. And Paul, I'd love to get your take on this from your standpoint and the conversations you have with clients. What's that dynamic like to navigate with them and the conversations you have about this intersection of NIL and taxes?
Yeah, so it's a great point because like Hans just said, for a lot of people, it's their first material income. And so you don't know that the amount in the check isn't all that you can't spend the whole check, right? A big chunk of that, I'm shocked every year at the size of withholding and deductions that get taken out for taxes. So I can imagine if it's your first check, there's definitely a rude awakening there. But I would say I'd answer this in two parts. One, it's like from the perspective of someone representing their client and the team, as being part of the team, like, your wealth manager, your advisor, your lawyer, potentially your agent, their job is to say, okay, from the gross amount that comes in, here's how we can sort of maximize what you get to keep. There's tax planning strategies that can be implemented. Again, we're not accountants. I'm not a tax lawyer, although there's people in the building and in my firm that do a lot of tax. I'd say when you're making significant money, that can be worthwhile. Sort of when it's your first deal, if it's small dollars, baseline thing to know is I think if you earn over 600, the NCAA makes you report it. If you earn over 400, you have to file a tax return, although you may not owe any taxes. I think the cap right now is if you earn over $13,850 in a year, then you have to start paying taxes beyond that. So that's the basic gist. And then, beyond that, if it's a multi-year deal and if it's a lot of money, maybe some of it's deferred. If you're getting some of it in equity, maybe you can structure some of it as, not ordinary income, maybe more of a capital gain. There's all kinds of different things you can do when it gets larger dollars and more complicated. And your team will help you walk through that. But the other thing is, as between sort of a brand or a collective and the individual player, student athlete, it's really more like the brand is going to say, hey, your taxes are your own liability. We're not handling that for you. To the extent tax is owed on your income, you're responsible for that. We're not. So basically, that's kind of how it works. Now, if it was large dollars, you may say, hey, and if it's a conference, maybe you want to get paid in a state that's more tax friendly than a state that isn't. But a lot of it's going to deal with, where you're rendering the services, where the university is based. Again, it's a huge topic, but hard to answer in the abstract.
Sure. But I appreciate you kind of sharing your insight there, Paul. That's really good stuff to consider. And guys, let's face it, at the end of the day, Uncle Sam's always going to make sure that he gets what, he deserves, if you will. Before we wrap up, a lot of considerations on the table for everybody out there surrounding NIL deals, that is. Any final comments or thoughts you guys want to share before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure, Ryan. The one thing that I'll add just before we close out for today is student athletes should know that there are options to manage risk when it comes to your NIL deals. So for one, the NCAA actually has what's called the Exceptional Student Athlete Disability Insurance Program. It enables student athletes to purchase disability insurance with pre-approved financing and really protects them from future loss of earnings if they ever get injured or get sick over the course of their college careers. So in addition to that, any valuable assets attained as a result of any major NIL deal should be insured above anything above the limits of traditional property insurance policies, can be protected using umbrella insurance policies.
And I would say, Hannes, Max, Ryan, what we're talking about NIL right now in February 2024, the situation could be completely different next year or in 6 months. And it was already different, last year. So, there's so many things that are changing. It's hard to give someone a static answer. But I think if you understand the fundamental economic picture, which is sports, particularly football and basketball, are worth a lot of money. And athletes that are sort of like elite in those sports can command compensation, whether it's in the form of NIL or being paid to play, there's a market for it. And as long as you sort of understand that there's a market for it and that you have worth, you should be able to sort of navigate the principles. Although What's allowed or disallowed will change week to week, month to month. You just have to have a good team in place to help you navigate it.
Have someone like Paul on your team because he knows a lot about the topic.
That's great. Well, thank you guys. Really appreciate everybody here carving time out of their schedules to be on today's, you know, today's episode. Hannes and Max, if anybody out there has any additional conversations or questions surrounding the NIL process, what is the best way they could reach out to you two and open up a dialogue?
Well, they can certainly call us here in our office in New York at 212-713-952 or send us an email at hannes.grosch@ubs.com. But more importantly, they can also reach out to Paul, who is a real expert here. We're lucky to have him on. And his number is 212-801-6856 or his email, paul.sarker@gtlaw.com.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, once again, thank you for your time today and looking forward to being back on the next with you, Hannes and Max. And Paul, appreciate your time and expertise today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Of course, of course. And hey, folks, we want to take a final moment here and thank everybody in our audience for spending some time with us, of course, on the show. If you did enjoy today's conversation or you learned a thing or two, make sure you hit that subscribe button on whichever platform you checked us out on today so that you don't miss out on any future content coming down the road, whether it's conversations between Hannes, Max, and I on wealth management strategies or bringing on a guest expert like Paul Sarker today to discuss NIL deals. By subscribing to the show, you'll never miss out on some of that juicy stuff. Before Hannes and Max, and of course, Paul, I'm Ryan. We're going to go ahead and say so long today. We appreciate you stopping by and being with us on Through the Wealth Lens. This communication is intended to be used for educational purposes only and does not constitute a solicitation to purchase any security, insurance, or advisory service. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. An investment in any security involves significant risks, and any investment may lose value. Refer to all risk disclosures related to each security product carefully before investing. This commentary is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed may not be officially those of UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and the firm does not verify nor guarantee the accuracy or completeness of the information presented. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products and services we offer. For more information, please review the PDF document at ubs.com/relationship summary.